Campus FM presents Treasures from Malta. This episode was originally recorded for the Treasures from Malta podcast series, produced by Fondazione Patrimonio Malti. Hello and welcome to Treasures from Malta, a podcast series produced by Fondazione Patrimonio Malti. I am Francesca Balzan, an art historian and an artist with a long connection with Patrimonio. I'll be presenting this podcast and meeting some of Malta's living treasures. These treasures are artists, historians or art collectors with some Malta connection. They're all fair game for the pod and we want to share them with you. Hi everyone, today we have Teresa Zammitlupi on the podcast. Welcome Teresa.
Hi Francesca, good morning.
Teresa Zammitlupi. Book and paper conservator, academic and author, but also bell ringer and tango dancer. Ter, we've been friends from our teenage years, which was a really long time ago.
Yes.
Always so much to catch up on whenever we met in between your stays abroad. Firstly, but let's go back really far back. Where did you grow up and were you already interested in art as a child?
I grew up in a very lively household. I mean, we were four children, grew up in St. Julian's in this house with a garden. They were very happy years. I mean, I had an excellent childhood and, we always did things together and there was always this, exposure to art in the sense of perhaps not art in the pure sense of the word, but more, an exposure to materials, to having a garage that was full of things which were available, cardboard, paint, color, whatever you wanted, you know. My mother's a very creative person. She could sew, she cooks, you know, really well, and she'd do things with her hands. Same with my father, you know. And there was also very much this disposition for, if you're interested in something, we'll provide it, you know. If I'm interested in art, I'd get a set of paints. Christmas, a Christmas present or whatever, or we bought a book or, so there was always this encouragement.
Sounds like a good start in art. How did you then make the step eventually to study art history?
It started, well, I knew already at 17 that I wanted to do conservation.
Wow, that's early. It's so specialized.
Extremely early, it's true. But it happened really because there was this article in the National Geographic magazine to which my father was subscribed. And this article was, the special issue was about the restoration of the Cappella Sistina. And I was in awe when I read this article and I said, that's it, I want to become a conservator. It was one of these moments, you know. And, but I was still 17, you know, I mean, the possibility to study conservation in Malta were non-existent, you know, the conservation center in Big wasn't yet set up. And I had to go abroad to do this. And I remember going to speak to Joseph Skiro, who was then at the National Library. And he told me, look, he said, you're still young. Why don't you do a first degree in a related subject? And I remember him suggesting classics and archaeology. And and I said, ah, true, you know, it makes sense. So I decided to do history of art and archaeology. And in hindsight, it made perfect sense to do that. Before embarking on my course in conservation, which I did later. The history of art gives you a background in objects, the understanding of materials, the understanding of periods and styles and provenance. So of course, eventually when I began to treat objects, once I qualified and everything, it made perfect sense to give me a good background in the understanding of the arts. When I finished my history of art degree, I then went to Florence and eventually to London to further my studies. So yes, this is how it all came about.
It sounds like you were unwavering in your determination. You knew from age 17 and you just continued with that on that path.
Yes, it's true. In fact, when I look at it, I sort of look at myself a bit sort of objectively and I say, my goodness, yes, I was really determined to do this and almost nothing else, you know. There was a time I was interested in doing law and then I, you know, perhaps because it was very popular and still is very popular. And I was studying languages at sixth form, you know, so that was the natural progression towards law. If you had languages, you know. But I found that very boring, you know, and I said, you know, no, I love art. I have to pursue a career in art. So, yes, definitely.
In fact, History of Art had just been set up as a course at university by Professor Mario Bohajar. Right. So you actually were one of the earlier intakes, presumably.
Yes, I think I was the third or fourth year of students of intake. It was a very good course, and I look back at my 4 years at university very much with nostalgia, and they did give me a very, very good formation. So, yes.
So, once one becomes a paper conservator, what is the actual job like? Well, what does a paper conservator actually do?
I should start by saying that in the book and paper conservation world, it is sort of divided into two main branches, what we call flat works, the conservation of flat works, so that's drawings and maps and watercolors, engravings, you know, works of art on paper. Mm-hmm. And books, so you have manuscripts and printed books, so sort of three-dimensional objects, which are different because, of course, you have bookbinding structures, you have the mechanics of a book, the way it works, as opposed to a single folio, a sheet of paper where you have a watercolor. So there are different problematics as well related to both areas, you know, because in flat works you have problems with color, and with solubility of color and different media. So they're also very, very complex. So in the book and paper world, we would say they're largely divided into two areas. You asked me what conservation actually involves. Well, I would say there's conservation and there's preservation. So conservation is actually the hands-on treatment of an object. So you have, I don't know, a watercolor which is stained or manuscript which has torn folios, and they're fixed with using different techniques and different methodologies. So that is the actual hands-on treatment. But then there's also preservation, which is extremely important and sometimes, I wouldn't say forgotten or disregarded, but it's sort of, when one thinks of a conservator of the work we do, it's always this image of somebody with a scalpel or brush in their hands, but not quite a person who is looking after collections. And preservation is extremely important because we're talking about surveying collections, assessing them, ensuring that they are in good shape and stored properly using the right environmental parameters. And also the way objects are put on display, for example, that's also part of preservation, you know, exhibitions, loans, how these happen, how they come, how they travel, how they go from A to B, and how they're put on display, the lighting conditions, how they're handled, they're touched. All these things are extremely important and are part of our work. And of course, if preservation isn't carried out or isn't carried out the way it should be, then of course you get problems with conservation. Yeah. So, you know, this one thing is leads to the other.
So if one were to make an analogy, the work of a conservator can be divided into maintaining the health of a body, for example, if you have to take the analogy with the human body, and that's the preservation aspect, as opposed to actually repairing, undertaking first aid on the body or surgery, where you have to reverse the effects of bad preservation.
Exactly. It's exactly like the human body, actually. It's a very good analogy, because if you eat well, if you take care of yourself, likelihood is that you're going to have less problems with your health and less interventions. Mm-hmm. So you need less medication. Yeah. So that's exactly it, you know.
So in terms of awareness, do you have to tell people once you repair any object that they bring to you, do you actually give advice about preventative conservation for the future? People, you know, make sure that there isn't a humid environment where they're going to hang the work or preserve it or store it.
Definitely. First of all, this normally comes about when a client brings an object or when I go to assess a collection, the first thing is I diagnose where the problem is, where is it coming from. And then as a consequence, when the object is repaired and back in shape, I have to ensure that the object is going back to an environment which was not in the way it was before. Mm-hmm. So, yes, absolutely. In fact, this is one of the things that I write in my reports, you know. I actually state, you know, that, I don't know, for example, if it's a watercolor print drawing, that it shouldn't be exposed to direct sunlight, that it shouldn't have, you know, direct sources of heat around it, like a fireplace or, you know, this sort of thing, which are, you know, important recommendations for people to understand. It's true. It's a household. In the end, it is a home. If it's going to a home, and not a museum, but still, of course, if one wants to take care of one's objects, you have to follow guidelines.
That is all pretty straightforward, and people can obviously follow the advice and all that. Mm-hmm. However, there are the other problems, for example, ethical challenges that come along with conservation. Just to give you an example, what would you do if one important artifact overlays another? And I'll give you an example, a concrete example that we had come across in the Palazzo Falson Historic House Museum Library in Indina. We've got a volume which is a couple centuries old. So it's an important artifact in its own right. But what is really interesting is that within the spine, actually used to hold the spine together, is a fragment, a manuscript fragment, which has what seems to be Carolingian text on it. We can't see it properly because it's wedged in the spine. And what we'd like to do, of course, is to detach the text block from the cover. Is that ethically acceptable? Do you come across these sort of issues?
Yes, that's a very important question, actually, and an interesting one too. Every object has a biography; it has a life, and like an archaeological mm-hmm. site, very often, especially with books, you have multi-period mm-hmm. layers of different interventions that happened along the years. And the case that you're mentioning of this book, I know exactly which one you're talking about. Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, there are different technologies to be able to look at that Carolingian fragment beneath. One can use X-ray, and there are scientific ways of looking at different strata without having to touch or dismantle anything. Secondly, one has to see the function of that book. So I never say an outright no. Because there has to be an understanding of what's going on. One has to assess the condition of that book. If it's in perfect shape, then obviously I wouldn't touch it. But if it is, it needs treatment, and there is a case for some dismantling of that part of the book, then that could be an opportunity to look at those Carolingian fragments and put them back in again after treatment, for example.
So reversibility is super important in that
yes.
case.
Extremely important. I worked on a similar sort of situation at the Notarial Archives. There's a very important manuscript, which is, they're notarial deeds, which are bound with a Portolan chart, a wonderful nautical chart. Mm-hmm. Now this Portolan, was in very bad shape. And so we were in this dilemma, what to do, you know, do you put the chart back on as a cover?
Let me take you back one. Why was it bound in a Portolan chart of all things? How on earth was it wrapped around a volume with notarial deeds?
Notarial documents were by law meant to be covered in parchment. Now, parchment is a very an expensive commodity. So having parchment skins available at hand by a bookbinder would have been often difficult. And, you know, unless you had the money to buy fresh new skins, you would use recycled material. So in the case of this Portolan, this Portolan was cut in half, literally, quite literally, and used as a cover for these notarial deeds. Now, when we discovered that there's this portalan as a cover, we were really in awe, you know, I mean, like amazing, mm-hmm. they find this cover. And instinctively, one would want to see what there is, you know, and undo it and dismantle the whole thing. The thing is that the manuscript itself was in bad shape. The sewing structure was broken and parts of the portalan were lost. So there were parts which had completely deteriorated. Mm-hmm. So the decision was, what do we do? Do we leave things as they are, mm-hmm. not touch anything at all? Or do we remove everything, dismantle, repair the portalan, get it back into a two-dimensional object as it mm-hmm. originally was, and give the notarial acts a new cover, which is what we decided what to do.
So total detachment. One object became two at that stage.
Exactly, exactly. One object became two. And we did this precisely for this reason, because I'm very careful about, you know, touching and intervening. I am rather of the minimalist approach. I'd rather not touch anything at all than intervene. But considering that these acts were important to be handled and to be studied, and they were in bad shape, then we decided to do what we did. Of course, nowadays, there's digitization. I mean, you can digitize anything, really. Leave everything as it is without intervening at all.
You spoke in the plural. You said we. Do you draw in the expertise and the opinions of other people to give you comfort in taking these difficult decisions?
Well, in the case of this particular portalan, definitely. I mean, if it's an important piece, and here I'm talking about an institutional collection, mm-hmm. so the notarial archives. It's not a private artwork where you're dealing just with a client and a one-to-one thing. So yes, I took the advice of. For example, Joan Abella, who is the historian who has been contributing to the notarial archives for years now. And I would also take advice from other conservators. So, mm-hmm. The conservators in the team at the notarial archives, as well as other conservator friends of mine abroad, and I would research and look into it, you know. Yes, so there is a lot of ethics here in as to what to treat, how much to treat. You know, you have to respect the historicity of the object and its life history. So yes, you know, there's a lot of balance to be made.
Mm-hmm. Let's zoom out of objects and turn to another aspect of your life, which is related anyway. All your travels. You've been to Siena, you've been to Switzerland, Cambridge, UK, to Cambridge, Massachusetts. You've really been everywhere and anywhere. The best traveled conservator I actually know. Give us a flavor of where you've lived and what projects you are doing there in relation to books and paper conservation.
Okay, I think one of the life-changing experiences for me was when I had just finished my master's degree and I was on this internship at Christ Church College in Oxford. And I did this for two consecutive summers. So in the end, I had spent about 4 months, 6 months there. And I think, the work was really quite beautiful in a very beautiful college library, you know, all these leather and parchment bindings. So even the setting is really idyllic. And I was working on the collection of Henry Aldrich's albums. Henry Aldrich was the Dean of Christ Church in the 17th century. And he amassed this wonderful collection of albums which contain incredible drawings and prints. I mean, we're talking of Rembrandt, you know, this sort of thing, really top notch.
Quality, yeah.
But more than the collection itself, I think it was the people I was working with. So the international flavor, you know, of these teams. And the woman who was running this project, Kate Colleran, to whom I remain grateful to this very day, because she saw in me the ability to carry on studying conservation, and she really did encourage me, you know, and I really am indebted to this woman. But it's as I say, it's the international flavor. I remember in the evenings at Oxford, we used to go to the pub, you know, as pub when you're in England. And we used to be a group of about, 15, 20 book and paper conservators all together from, you know, the different colleges, from the Bodleian Library. So we used to be there talking, and it was so, so enriching. And I remained in touch with many of these people to this very day. And so my life experience in Oxford and in London, where I had studied, were, I think, really, really life-changing, because this led then to many other projects. And you mentioned, yes, the Sinai, I was so lucky to be working in the Monastery of St. Catherine on Mount Sinai. This was a project which was led by Nicholas Pickwood, who was also my PhD supervisor eventually. The project was brilliant. I mean, we were a team of, each time would be 6 or 8 conservators, very international again. And the work involved looking at the manuscripts and early printed books in the collection, and doing an assessment of them. So looking at their book structures, the makeup of them, and their condition. And here we're talking about the oldest, one of the oldest libraries in the world, you know. I mean, we're talking of 4th, 5th, 6th century manuscripts.
What does it feel to be actually handling these treasures? Because these are the treasures of humanity, not just of a nation, but they're incredible objects. Is it scary? Or do you have to shelve that awe and just get on with it?
You don't really shelf the awe, no. I don't think you do shelf the awe. Yes, it goes with a lot of responsibility, of course, to handle such objects. But the excitement and the thrill in doing so is really remarkable. And I kept saying to myself, you know, I am so lucky to be doing this.
Yes. They're also loaded with a sacred dimension to them as well, because presumably many of them were prayer books or Bibles.
Yeah. Yeah.
So as well, that is yet another aspect that I suppose you need to take into consideration in handling the object.
Yes, of course. Well, I mean, whether it is a sacred book or a secular book makes no difference in the way you handle it per se.
It's sacred to you, of
sacred,
course.
Always. It's always sacred. You know what I mean? But, but yes, I think it's more than anything else working in an Orthodox monastery here in the middle of Muslim territory. And when you think about it, you know, I mean, this monastery, which is in the middle of the desert, with these, it's a fortified monastery, because the walls are Justinian. I mean, you know, you're talking of 6th century here. And I think the whole setup in itself is...
it's essentially a masculine domain as well, so even that...
Yes, and in fact, to be selected to go there was quite a feat, in the sense that because it is... male religious monastery, they're quite strict as to who enters and all the rest of it. So first they were selecting Greek male conservators, and then they ran out of those, and they introduced male conservators who are not Greek, and then they ran out of those as well. So they were calling in female Greek conservators, and then I came into category 4, which is the non Greek female conservators. You know, so I mean, it's they are very strict about as to who enters, and it's not just about qualifications or who you are. It's not that. It's also
a sacred space. It has additional layers to it. But would you say that was the most unusual and challenging place to work, or have there been others?
I worked in another monastery in Egypt, a Coptic monastery, this time in the Wadi Natroun, which is between Cairo and Alexandria. And I was working on some very beautiful early 11th, 12th century religious texts again. The conditions were very difficult to work with, you know.
Basic accommodation, I would assume.
The accommodation, lack of facilities, you know, like hot water and you know, sort of the hygiene and all this and that. They're not easy environments, but you have to forget everything else. You're there, you're focused, and you're just working on manuscripts. And the joy in doing that supersedes everything else. Mm. You know, you, I mean, I had a similar experience in Ethiopia. I was there for a month in the north of Ethiopia on the border with Eritrea, where there are the current problems, actually. I was in Mekele, exactly in that same town. And we were working on, this was a project I was working on with the University of Hamburg. And the conditions, I wouldn't tell you. I mean, we're working in the Ministry of Tourism, which was a little apartment on the seventh floor of this building. There was no lift, electricity, mm-hmm. Power cuts every half an hour, so you couldn't do anything, the moment you try to put on a piece of equipment to use it, you get a power cut. There was no hot water even to wash our brushes, these are very basic things which you take so much for granted in your daily life because they're there, are not there, and it makes work very difficult to cope with, But, as I say, the excitement of working on such material, the people you meet each time, and the teamwork, because, for example, in Ethiopia, we were a group of nine people, four mm-hmm. conservators and five philologists. So they are manuscript scholars. They are people who know the language, who know Amharic and can read it. But we couldn't work without them, and they couldn't work without us.
But how enriching to have a team like that around mm-hmm. you.
Hugely enriching.
Of course.
And I see this relevance to my work as well mm-hmm. today. For example, in these last years when I was working at the notarial archives, I cannot work without a historian or a paleographer.
Yes.
They can't work without conservators.
Definitely. You've mentioned countries which are politically unstable. Have you at any point felt threatened?
I don't think so, no, not really. I mean, the thing is the people who organize these projects are very careful that we go at a time when it is safe to travel and safe to work. So I had spent almost...
Because in a way, books can wait, I suppose, unless they are endangered by a flood or something like that.
Exactly. So, I worked in Egypt, apart from the monasteries, I worked in Cairo proper and the city. But this was just before the revolution in 2011.
My goodness.
So, and then exactly when the revolution started, work had stopped.
Of course.
And get out. And, they didn't allow the teams to travel anymore. Mm-hmm. So it was, obviously our safety comes before anything else in this respect. So.
Of course.
And, as you say, these books are 1,500 years old. They can wait a decade or so until we can work on them again.
And on this note of waiting, I think it will be a good place to take a break. This episode originally recorded for the Treasures from Malta podcast series and now being broadcast on Campus FM is a conversation between me, Francesca Balzan, and my guest, book and paper conservator, Dr. Teresa Zamitlupi. And we're back. I do want to mention that pictures and links to artworks and places we mentioned will be in the program notes on the podcast section at www.patrimonio.org. Now, back to Teresa. Ter, beyond the hands-on conservation of paper artifacts, you also do a lot of lecturing. Give us some examples of courses you've run.
I've done short courses abroad and in Malta. The ones I've done abroad were mostly either through the Institute of Conservation. I do courses on the history of parchment making and codicology in the history of the book. I've done courses at the University of Graz in Austria. I've organized summer schools on the history of the book, which were also really fascinating because we brought different people together, historians and librarians and archivists and conservators. So it was a very, very enriching experience there. I've lectured at New York University and different universities anyway, always on the history of the book primarily and on illuminated manuscripts. In Malta, I've been asked to lecture in different departments at the university. I've done one-off lectures in the history of art department, courses in the liberal arts, and the Institute of Baroque Studies. Mm-hmm. They always have courses restoration. But more recently, in these last 2 years, I've also given courses in the Department of Chemistry, which was quite interesting because...
How did that come about?
What's fascinating is that they're encouraging students in chemistry and physics and even biology to have a better understanding of the arts. And because conservation is really a marriage of both the arts and sciences, they're trying to encourage students who have a scientific background perhaps to take up a career in conservation science and areas related to the arts which they may not be so familiar with.
Another aspect of your career is research and publication. And yes, in 2011 you authored the book Cantate Domino, Early Choir Books for the Knights in Malta, which was published by Fondazione Patrimonio Malti. What was the book actually about?
Yes, and I have to say, apart from thanking Patrimonio for accepting to publish this book.
It's a beautiful tome.
Oh, how sweet you are. Thank you, Fran. But I think I owe a lot to you for this, because I remember speaking to you about this when I had just finished my PhD and I was, you know, wondering what to do with this research which nobody will look at.
Oh, I always encourage beauty. Of course, I would have encouraged you to publish it.
I remember coming to speak to you at Palazzo Palson when you were curator then, and you were really, really encouraging and very supportive about this. So I owe you a lot then. Well, the book is essentially, it is a reduced version of the PhD. I didn't include everything because that would have been terribly boring for readers. Essentially what I wrote about is, what I researched is a collection of illuminated choir books, the Lilla Dame choir books, because they were commissioned by the very Grand Master in 1533. They are housed at St. John's Co-Cathedral. There are magnificent set of manuscripts that were illuminated in France. We actually know the followers, the scriptorium that worked on the collection. They were followers of the illuminator Jean Pichot, who was very active in Paris and Rouen in the beginning of the 16th century. So the book is really about the makeup of these manuscripts. They are graduals, which means they are, they contain the music for the sung mass, as opposed to antiphonals, mm-hmm. which are contain the music of the sung divine office. And I make this distinction because very often people call them antiphonals, but they're not, they're graduals. Mm-hmm. So I discuss their history, of course, and their makeup. So how they were actually produced, the parchment skins, how the folios were prepared, how they were written, the text, the music, the arrangement, the illuminations, the production of the illuminations, and the history of Jean Pichot and his atelier. So that is the presentation of the book. That is what the book contains.
They are actually exquisite, really beautifully illuminated and painted. And in fact, the illustrations in your book really bring this to the fore. I think it's probably the most recent publication we have, and with the best images of these wonderful of this wonderful collection as well.
Definitely, and the images really do make the book. And in fact, Joe Borsch, the photographer, did a fantastic job, really. And he took a lot of interest in the subject. You know, we had long discussions, and it was really a joy to work with him. What is also interesting is that now in recent years, I discovered that in Harvard at the university, there's an older cousin of the Lilla Dame manuscripts there. I've been fortunate enough to go there and study that manuscript. And now through a grant that I received from the St. John's Co-Cathedral Foundation, I shall be researching the relationship between this older manuscript, which was produced by Jean Pichot, and our set in Malta. So this is a new bit of research which I am carrying on right now. So that
will this result in publication?
Yes, I will be publishing for sure.
So we look forward to that one as well. you've researched plenty of objects, you've obviously worked on a wide variety, but what would you say is the most memorable research project you undertook?
That's a very, very difficult question, Francesca.
I'm putting words in your mouth, of course. I just want you to say the Cantilena.
Okay, yes. You're probably right in that respect. Yes, well, the Cantilena was special because it is the Cantilena. It's the oldest piece of text written in Maltese. And being privileged to be able to work on its conservation was really something. I'm forever grateful to Joan Labella on having allowed me to do this and, you know, given me the responsibility to take it on. So the Cantilena per se is the manuscript that contains the Cantilena, really, because I should say that the manuscript contains notarial acts, and it's only one folio that contains the Cantilena. Mm-hmm. So you have 270 folios, and it's only one that contains the Cantilena.
And almost by coincidence, it made its way into this notarial volume. It just happened to be, perhaps you'd like to talk about it.
It's completely unrelated, in fact, to the notarial acts, because the notarial acts are of Brandano Casciaro, which dates between 1533 and 36. And then on the penultimate folio, you have this poem, mm-hmm. Which says, at the very top, it says that this was written by Pietro Casciaro, who was a relative of Brandano. Now, Pietro Casciaro died in 1480, so this poem must have been written before 1480 mm-hmm. and was probably recorded from memory mm-hmm. or copied mm-hmm. by Brandano on this lost folio.
How lucky that he used his lost folio as a scrap piece of paper, because that is essentially what he did.
Yes, well, the last four folios of this manuscript were blank, and he decided to include this poem very randomly. We don't know the reason why it was included, actually, because it's completely unrelated to the notarial acts. There's no connection whatsoever. Well, the beauty of it is, of course, in the language, and I won't go into that because I'm not a linguist and it's not my area, but a lot has been written and researched.
Covered extensively, yes.
Extensively, yes. So what I actually did was, the manuscript wasn't in good shape, you know, there was ink corrosion and it had been rebound in the early 20th century. So using acidic board, so it needed to be changed. It needed to be disbound and resewn. So I had to do research on similar manuscripts, you know, 16th century manuscripts, to see what style to give it and all the rest of it. So that was also very interesting, because I had to look into the makeup of the manuscript, you know, look at the paper and study the watermarks to understand where the paper was coming from. So yes, that was quite fascinating.
But talking about sacred texts, you know, we talked about it earlier. This isn't sacred, it's secular, but it must have felt, you know, the responsibility on you for handling something which is sacred to the Maltese language, the earliest document that actually has written Maltese language on it, must have been tremendous. How did that feel?
Yes, again, I mean, it's a huge responsibility, you know. I remember I was working on it in my studio at home, and I spent 11 days working on it, and I hardly left the house for those 11 days, except, you know, I just go around the corner to buy my groceries. But otherwise, I didn't leave the house. I was terrified, not because anyone would want to break in to choose to steal the Cantilena. It's a very unattractive piece, you know. But, you know, but the whole idea of having it in my studio was something that, you know, it kept me on edge.
I can well imagine.
I think the Cantilena project was fascinating, not because it is an important piece. It's not just that. I think mm-hmm. it's important for me personally, because this was the beginning of a huge experience that I embarked upon with Joan Abella at the Notarial Archives. You know, this was in 2013 mm-hmm. when I worked on this manuscript, and for successively from 2013 onwards till last year, I was heavily involved in the rehabilitation of the notarial archives and the salvage of this magnificent collection. Mm-hmm. So I think the Cantilena was a changing point in my in the years that were to come, you know, in terms of what I did for the notarial archives. So yes, it is extremely meaningful for in that respect as well.
Ter, the walls of your house are lined with books. I'm seeing them behind you in our Zoom chat. I can just see all your books. It's just so wonderful. It's a real temple to books, actually. You're a really big reader, obviously, and you collect all sorts of books, academic stuff, but also lots of novels. What type of books do you prefer to read in your downtime?
Increasingly, I'm finding less and less time to read, which is quite sad. But yes, when I do read, I have my favorite authors. I love Alain de Botton. We have a little bit of a story there around.
Yes, we do. Perhaps I should admit, because it's not typical of me. You lent me a book of his first time I read him, and I don't remember whether I returned it or not, and apparently I didn't return it. So, you know, to do that to Teresa's Ambit Loopy, you know, who has this temple of books at home, to actually lose one of her books is like the end of the world. So I quickly ordered one from Amazon, but it was so embarrassing.
I have no problem.
Blushing at the memory, believe me.
No, but yeah, apart from that, Alain de Botton is, I really like his writings. I think he's really clever. He's a contemporary philosopher, let's use the word very lightly. I mean, if who is a philosopher would say he's not, but he calls himself a philosopher. He writes about the most ordinary themes, really: work, love, sorrow, architecture, happiness, you know. And what's interesting is that there's an emphasis on the relevance of these subjects to everyday life, you know. And I really like the way he writes. Perhaps it's a little bit, you know, his sentences are really pregnant with meaning, you know.
Absolutely. I always felt that one sentence could lead to a PhD. So there's so much that it's so much that you can spin out of it.
Yes.
Hardly light reading for downtime,
but I really enjoy it, and it's I also like listening to his TED Talks, and I find that I've returned to his books time and time again, even for my lectures. You know, I mark them. I love his book.
And that's why it was such a great sin to lose your book, because it was already marked with your notes.
Don't worry about it.
How do you replace that?
Don't worry about it.
Somehow our friendship survived.
Oh, la harisle. I also recently discovered a very good writer called Anita Bruckner. She's an English novelist, and she's also an art historian, but I only found this about her incidentally, you know, that she's an art historian. But what I really like about her is that she explores themes like emotional loss and difficulties with associated with people fitting in society. But she writes
very universal themes as well, I suppose.
Very universal themes.
Yeah.
And unlike Alain de Botton, who discusses themes like love and philosophy and architecture, etc.
Abstract concepts.
Yes, abstract concepts. She's a novelist, so she would write, a proper narrative, a proper story.
They sound like workouts for the brain, both authors.
Yes, but Anita is, I think, a bit lighter. It was fascinating when I found out that she has a doctorate from the Courtauld Institute in art history. And I think there's this underlying, she would talk about a building if her protagonist is in front of her.
She'd have an essential knowledge and understanding of the vocabulary
and
of
I think
art there.
That probably was one of the attractions that drew me to her writings.
Have you got into the habit of reading through e-books or listening to audiobooks?
I have to say that I have never had a digital device for reading books, no Kindle or anything. Mm. But I am, okay, I do love books. I love the feeling of paper and the smell and this, mm-hmm. and allowing the book to fall on my nose when I'm falling asleep or whatever. You know, I mean, I love the handling of a book. But I wish to try to use a Kindle one day. I mean, I'm open to it, but I'm not particularly excited about the idea. You know,
when you run out of space,
probably I'll see to that when I get to it. But it's not something that drives me. You know,
I do read e-books, but I always go back to a physical book as well. The physicality of it, the actual turning the pages, and the one thing that really bothers me about e-books is that you forget the titles of the books you're reading because you're constantly seeing the cover, like you do with a book, with a physical book. You know, the first thing you do is see the cover and then open it on the page that you need to continue reading from.
Exactly. The idea of flipping can't really happen with an e-book.
That's another thing, because you lose your place. And but the loss of the cover, and for me, a cover is really important. I know you shouldn't judge a book by its cover, but I think that's a real fallacy, because I do judge books by their cover. They lead you, the art on the cover leads you to the sort of book you would know that you're going to enjoy somehow.
And my love for Anita Bruckner started off because I liked the covers. Because that's black and white photography, which is one of my favorite forms of art, actually. So it's all subconscious, you know.
There you go.
That's what drew me in.
He spoke to you on the level of the art historian.
It's true.
Listen, I'm always curious about this. And I need recommendations. What's the last great book you've read?
And I'm finishing it off. It's this book by Rutger Bregman called Humankind. Mm-hmm. It's Humankind, and it's got a subtitle, A Hopeful History. Mm-hmm. And it's quite interesting because he starts off by talking about these children who are salvaged on a desert island in the Pacific. Mm-hmm. And unlike, you know, the children in Lord of the Flies, which end up killing each other and hating each other, the children decide to work together as a team and to be generous and kind to each other and make it work. And they end up on this island for a year and a half, and they're perfectly civilized with one another. So his book is, it's about how deep down we are all decent human beings.
Social creatures.
There is hope for us as human beings. And I think this book is giving me, because I'm finishing it off, is what we need during this time, during this pandemic. We're coming across people who are feeling upset and depressed and hopeless, you know, really we have no hope. So it adds to this sense of misery we're going through, you know. So we do have to believe in that we can be good people for one another, you know.
And the miserable thing is that you can't indulge in your favorite hobbies, which are completely unusual. I'm going to take you to those. Bell ringing and tango dancing, how on earth did they come about?
Okay, so bell ringing was, I have to, this is all thanks to Kenny Skauke, who you also know, who's a metals conservator.
Bell King of Malta.
Yes, the campanologist of Malta. Who I was a colleague of mine. I mean, when I was working at Heritage Malta, he was there as well. And I remember in our breaks, he used to be talking about bells, and we would have be listening to him talking about that. And one time he said, why don't you just come along on a Sunday? And I went, you know, early in the morning, you have to be there for 7. And this is at St. John's Co-Cathedral. We went up on this tower with cuffs and everything, you know, for protection. And he gave me this the rope of this belt. And I said, no, I'm going to ring like this. He said, of course you're going to ring. Now, come on, you just go and you start ringing this Pinto bell, you know, 1720 or I don't know what it was. I mean, what?
And you with your delicate conservator's hands having to bash away at a bell.
A one-ton bell.
At a historic bell. So that
yes,
goes
yes.
Completely against your wish to preserve and to treat everything with kid gloves.
But, yes, so that was the beginning of something that I have been doing for 10 years now. It's a fascinating experience. And in its own way, I mean, you're up there in a bell tower, just a meter.
You must be second to none.
It's a wonderful sensation. And as there's a sense of liberation in ringing. Mm-hmm. And also a great sense of peace in that huge sound, you know, it's really deafening. I mean, you're just listening to your bell and your bell only, you know. Mm-hmm. But it is such a peaceful experience. Mm-hmm. I can't really describe it actually, but you're up there. There's the wind in your face because it's always very windy, you know, even if it's calm up there in a bell tower is always going to be breezy or windy. Mm-hmm. And you have the view of Valletta beneath you, the sea, the harbor, you see as far as Indina, it's early in the morning. Valletta hasn't yet woken up. It's a really wonderful experience.
Ironically, there's the great physicality of it that you're whacking away at this bell, you're bashing away at this bell, and, you know, you have to use all your force for it.
In actual fact, it's not as one would think. You don't have to use all your force for it. It's that's what I thought initially, but it's not like that. It's the way you pull at the rope. It's not how hard you pull at it. There are techniques which you learn obviously over time. That in actual fact, it's not as strenuous as you make it out to be, you know. I used to think it was like that, and in the beginning I used to feel achy all over, you know, but eventually, I mean, Kenneth was a fantastic instructor, and you learn how to do it in the right way. What's interesting is that bell ringing is not the same everywhere. And when I was living in Cambridge, I had joined the parish and the village where I was living, just outside Cambridge. And I used to bell ring with the Brits there. And it's quite interesting because they don't ring the way we ring. They change ring, which is completely different. Theirs is melodic, not rhythmic like ours.
I see.
And it's like learning a completely new language. I was, you know.
So you actually have to be able to have knowledge of music.
Yes, knowledge, and you have to follow very strict rules when it's your moment to enter. You know, you just ring. And so it was not easy at all. You know, it required a lot of training. I didn't really get the hang of it because by the time I left, I was just about beginning to learn how to ring. You know. And they're extremely rigorous. And
I see. So you didn't get that diploma. Don't worry.
No,
one day
I didn't.
One day you will. So tango. Tell me about tango dancing. Presumably you can't nowadays, obviously, because...
No.
I mean, the worst thing you can do is have your face very close to another person.
Not exactly. No, right now. tango dancing was really... It really happened very, very... unexpectedly, you know, I met a friend of mine and she said, why don't you come tango dancing? And I said, all right, I'll try, you know, I mean, it's really that sort of thing. And I started a very basic course for beginners first, and I got on well and I liked it. And I never had any background in dancing before, but I suppose it's also the music that's connected to the tango, which is very beautiful. You know, Argentine music is very...
Can you practice at home at all?
Have you been practicing? It's very difficult to dance without a partner. Yeah. So I do listen to tango music, though, quite often.
And you need a larger space as well, presumably. You can't be bumping into bookshelves.
Yes, but that's not really the main reason. The main reason is that you really do need to have a partner to dance properly with, you know.
But actually, bell ringing and tango dancing seem at polar opposites. But they are actually both linked by music. And in a way, even the books and papers you have worked on in your career, especially in your PhD, is about music. The contents are music. How important is music in your life?
Yeah, music is very important in my life. I grew up with music. Both my parents love music. My father is very knowledgeable about classical music and opera. And we always had music in the house, and my brothers and my sister as well would play the piano. And so, you know, yeah, music
grew
is
up with
important.
It.
Yeah, we grew up with it. And I think it's culture at home. You still have it remains with you, you know.
Did you study music at all?
Yes, I did study piano for about 10 years, which of course gave me a very good background in to understand the choir books at St. John's. And I mean, you know, any musical manuscripts that I worked on after that, which was, okay, to study the Lilada manuscripts, you needn't know music necessarily.
But it helps, I'm sure.
It helped enormously, you know, because you look at the collection from a different viewpoint, you know. So yes, it has been useful, and it is still very present in my life. You know, I listen to lots of music, all sorts of music, really, mostly classical.
Sarah, I won't keep you much longer, but finally, I have to ask you a question that we've all been asking each other. Where are you yearning to fly off to as soon as it's safe to travel?
I have lots of countries on my list.
Oh, I know.
Probably Italy, because it's close and you know, Italy.
I think it's your spiritual home, of course.
It is. Italy, and for any art lover, you know, Italy is just, you know, has to be top of your list.
Where in Italy in particular are you missing?
I managed to go to Rome in between the first and second wave in the summer when there were few cases. I managed to escape for a couple of days to Rome. And
how was that?
Deserted. It
oh
was
my goodness.
Beautiful.
Was it beautiful or a bit sad, actually, to see Rome?
I mean, it's sad because, you know, you don't have the buzz of tourists. Yeah. And you know, the shops open and the cafes, but on the other hand, you know, seeing a deserted Fontana di Trevi is a unique moment in history. I mean, you know, and being able to walk around the streets and photograph the squares in you know, it was really magnificent. So I'm sorry I didn't go to Venice actually in that period as well in summer, but anyway, then started getting complicated with flights and with traveling. So I dropped that. I'd love to go to Venice, but I think there would be many, many people having the same idea as mine. So I'm not sure.
On that sort of nostalgic note, I'll bid you goodbye and thank you so much for your time. It's been wonderful catching up with you.
Thanks so much, Francesca. It's always a real pleasure to talk to you. It's really fun.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Treasures from Malta on Campus FM. This was originally recorded as a podcast, and there are pictures and links to all we've discussed on the Fondazione Patrimonio Malti website under the podcast section. That's www.patrimonio.org.